sometimes they have to kill us. They have to kill us. Because they can't break our spirit.
We choose directly who we are. We know the difference between the reality of freedom and the illusion of freedom. There's a way to live with Earth and a way not to live with Earth. We choose the way of Earth. It's about power.
Friends, this is your co-host, Will Bluewater. Join us now to learn how to legally worship using indigenous earth-based healing and empowering ceremonies. Aho. As Bluewater, seventh great-grandson of Old Tassel, first beloved man of the Cherokee, I'm remembering what Old Tassel said to the prevailing culture. Many proposals have been made to us to adopt your laws, your religion, your manners, and your customs. We have done so. Now it is time for our cultures to accept Old Tassel's ways and assisting us to walk in harmony with Mother Earth and Father Sky. Aho.
Grandfather, teach me the ways of the old, so that I may remember who I am.
Oh my gosh, you know, my mic was off during that entire thing. I apologize. I'm going to start over. Our guest this evening is Jonathan Buffalo. He runs the Mishwaki Cultural Center and Museum. It's the Historic Preservation Department of the Sac and Fox Tribe of the Mississippi. The Mishwaki are not well known in popular culture, but they have been well documented in academic circles. The tribe almost single-handedly brought down New France. Yay for you. They rejected attempts toward being Christianized, including an attempt by Dr. Charles Eastman to convert them in 1897, and resisted going to boarding schools. They rejected the No Dancing Letter of February 24, 1923, which attempted to suspend powwows by hosting a big powwow event that attracted 3,000 Iowans in a day. This is an amazing history, and we're looking forward to talking with Jonathan about it. And say hello, Mr. Buffalo.
Hello. Can you hear me?
We sure can. We sure can. And what we'd like to do is what we'd usually do is Mark Borcherding would like to tell you about your Mayan birthday and its glyph, and maybe give you a little insight into why you do what you do. And all of our guests have found this fascinating. I know I did. Anyway, go ahead, Mark. Tell Jonathan about his Mayan birthday.
Jonathan, it's not bad.
No, it's yours is on a day called Seven Akbal, which is the center of a 13-day cycle of Kaban or Olin. Movement, thought, and energy, tied sometimes to literally the thought and movement of Creator. So it's kind of the centering day of that particular cycle. And the seven Akbal is composed of two parts, the seven, which is the day number, and the Akbal, which is the glyph. And each of them has a meaning we'll go into here real quick. The seven kind of talks about ability and to have energy to catalyze things, cause things to happen, right? And it can be involved in a kind of a struggle between kind of right and wrong. And in some cases, even almost a final testing of things. The Akbal part of the glyph, that one has to do with the creating a new cycle, new day. It's associated with caves, the underworld, and the sun traveling through the underworld to start a new day. So it's involved with the birthing, the awakening of things, opportunities of that sort. So you can kind of put those two together and kind of come up with the ability to change and catalyze and cause new things to happen, sort of. Akbal and the Kojis of the South America, Akbal would also be loosely be associated with what they call a luna as well, or the kind of deeper reality, underlying reality of all things. Now, in next part of the reading I'm going to do is going to be dealt with another Zulkin, which is called the Sixth Sun Zulkin. So it's going to have three components: a forward flow of time, a backward flow of time, where the two time flows come together in a unity point. And so we'll do the forward flow, the way we normally think of time, first. And this is kind of from your birth moving forward. And it's a 11 eek. We see probably about half of our guests come up with an eek glyph, and Blue Otter's glyph is an eek. It's not 11, it's a 9, but close enough. And the eek glyph is a glyph of... a T-cross shape, and it's a glyph of spirit, communication, things like that. And this one's about, especially about sharing things, spiritual things, prayer, the liberation, especially about the liberation of things for people. And it has some partnering energy here that would be the Jaguar energy. So ability to kind of move outside of the normal realm of time, kind of things we would call mystical things or mystical life, stuff like that, brought into the aspect of the prayer, especially when areas that have to do with kind of things that are polarizing, like good, evil, hot, cold, stuff like that. You know, things get kind of pretty black and white. Now, we'll move on to other flow of time here, the backward flow, and you have one that's ego energy here. And this is stuff, what we're talking about right now would be stuff that you might have seen showing up more recently in your life. Like, you know, around in the year 1997, 98, a little bit before, a little bit after that, and this type of stuff may be showing up possibly more. And it's more about things, the ego energy, vision, revelations of things, but in a sense of service and healing and prophecies and stuff. It has another aspect here of liberation of things. So, and that tying in another level above kind of the prophetic level. So, a lot of stuff here seems to be pointing towards, you know, being able to use your ability of visions and spiritual stuff there and having it directing into things that work with service of other, to help other people in humanity and healing of things quite through that. You may even have a possibility of may even have developed some ability, either knowingly or unknowingly, possibly, I'm not saying this definitively, but possibly, with literally being able to heal stuff with hands or in some way, some fashion. Now, where these two time flows come together, forward and backward flow, yours comes into a day which bears two two new, both the day number and the glyph are both new to this Zolk'in from the current Mayan Zolk'in. So, and they are composed of one, the day number has to do with truth, and the glyph is literally peace. So truth and peace are probably becoming a really important thing to you here recently, and literally, in a sense, forms a energy to bring you from our world cycle as we move into the next world cycle. It also has the energy here, kind of a partnering or sidekick energy or whatever. It's about balance of things, bringing in the big things in balance. Has an aspect of here of kind of doing things in kind of a little bit more a simple or childlike fashion. This particular day number and glyph I'm looking at is also directly connected, especially to two white buffalo calves. The white buffalo calves' names is Miracle and Miracle Second Chance, both born in Janesville, Wisconsin. The one in, I think, August 20th, 1990 were for Miracle, and August 25th, 2006 for Miracle Second Chance. This particular energy here is directly related to both of those particular white buffalo. So those white buffalo and the power of those and pretty much the whole thing with the white buffalo calf woman will probably be an important part of the truth and peace part that you're working with and working towards. That will get you through things, but also you'll bring a bunch of other people with you. essentially an entire community, maybe a planet. But there'll be some... it's sitting in a cycle, this peace and truth thing is sitting in a cycle that has a lot to do with pretty big change on big level in terms of, you know, we tend to look at it as death. But, you know, things change. And in the Mayan tradition, and many native cultures, I think, they have a different perspective on death and change of things. Mayans looked at death as actually literally, and not just the Mayans, but the other Mesoamericans too, and other natives, that death is literally the seed of life. So out of it comes the new life. Something dies in order for something to be born, kind of that idea. You have here, I'm seeing a lot of things that are really, several things that I'm looking at here that are actually tying in with this whole white buffalo thing quite a bit. So I would not be surprised if you're already aware of that and see it happening in your life and had already some interesting experiences with that. Some of them maybe if you have, you might want to share them with us. But that's something that's showing up in multitudes of pathways that I'm looking at here right now in different cycles. Let me see. I'm going to look at that one, the eagle thing, a little bit more and see on that one. That one has some balance stuff coming in with it, too. That balance thing is there again. So that balancing and also with light, a certain type of spiraling light, which is how our creation operates. So that might be something in your whole healing aspect is that thing about spiraling light. Let me see your eat thing here. Let me see. Did I get the right thing here? I'm looking up. Oh, there it is. Okay, yeah. That one's also connecting back into white buffalo, specifically, let's see, 16, 15, so that was the birth of the white buffalo named Miracle Second Chance. So I'm seeing a lot of that white buffalo energy here, especially with those two particular white buffaloes, Miracle and Miracle Second Chance, born in Janesville, Wisconsin.
Sounds like you have the right name. Yeah. Well, how does that sound? Does that sound anything like your life, Jonathan?
Parts of it.
Okay. Well, while you think about that, tell us a little bit about yourself and, you know, where you're born and how you chose your path, and just let your mind just kind of go into neutral and let, if you feel like letting Creator speak through you, you know, go right ahead. But tell us about your nation and the highs and the lows, whatever you'd like to say.
Well, my name is Jonathan L. Buffalo. That's my Social Security card, driver's license, taxpayer name. That makes me survive the outside world. But my Squawky name is Kishkinanos. And it's two words. It's Kishki, which means cut, and Nanoso means a buffalo. So it's, the name translates, if you translate it just for word, it means cut buffalo or half buffalo. But the word means a mer buffalo, half buffalo, half fish. That's what my name means. And I was born on the settlement in an attic. And I've always lived on the Meskwaki Indian settlement, and except for when I went to college, in the college years, and that was only school year, you know. And I'm a very traditional Meskwaki. I believe in the deities of my ancestors, and I have three kids. And I was married, then got divorced, then got remarried to the woman I should have married in the first place.
Uh-huh.
But I wouldn't have my three kids if I had. I would have different kids. So, my people are very, very traditional. You know, we're ordinary. Sometimes we look deceiving because we dress like typical Iowans, because we buy our clothes at Walmart, Kmart. So, dress-wise, we look like Iowa people. The English we speak has an Iowa accent. We made it Meskwaki English. You know what I mean?
Yep.
We speak Iowan, but with an Indian accent, because that's the English we learned from our neighbors. So, incidentally, our cousin tribe, the Sac and Fox of Oklahoma, when they speak English, they talk like Southerners.
Uh-huh.
Which is very strange. But, you know, on the outside we've accepted certain things. Technology. I'm speaking to you on a phone. We use computers. We watch movies. We eat pizza, you know, and in that part, we're typical Americans, in a sense, typical American people. But it's the inside that's Meskwaki. And that's what we kind of protect more, the inner self of being Meskwaki, of saying, my Creator created me on this continent. I'm a Meskwaki. I come from no place else. I did not come from Mesopotamia. And we still practice our traditional religion as best as we can, as pure as we can, even though we know times have changed. You know, we were confident that our ancestors of 500 years ago, if they met us, they would recognize us as Meskwakis. Maybe a little bit dumb. Maybe maybe talking a little strange. Yeah. But we would be like babies if we met our ancestors of 500 years ago. But at least I think they would recognize us and accept us, because we still hold to those truths we believe in that they did. And the only thing that's changed is time for us, you know. We know why people came and changed our world, you know. But 500 years ago, those Meskwakis, when they woke up in the morning, it was their world, period. So that's what we think, that they would recognize us. You know, I don't know how many tribes can say that, because some tribes have totally changed in their ideas of who they are. And the only thing they have left is a federal name. So, and we try, we've struggled to say, to be able to say that. We've struggled and we've fought. And I'm not saying we're the best people in the world. We have our ups and downs. We have our noble times, and we have our tantrums, and we have our, sometimes our ugly side to our history. That's about it.
Well, that's, you just like everybody else. You just have some different beliefs, and you know, that's what America's supposed to be all about, and I'm glad that America's finally starting to wake up to that. And it's only been, you know, about 40 years since they really codified your right to believe the way you want to do. And but yeah, you know, I was reading, you know. I mean, you had a Sac and Fox of Kansas was elected as Warren G. Harding's vice president, and we can thank you for helping chase the French off the continent, and which, you know, which is probably got a proud history, and.
Well, maybe Blue Otter. I'm not sure if a lot of people know that much about this particular tribe. So, you know, maybe he could give us a quick rundown of kind of the tribe itself and what they're about, and then kind of because I think maybe people might be interested in hearing about
the tribe
and its origins and such, and
language group, and a little bit of ethnology.
Yeah, kind of the history.
Okay, we're an Algonquin-speaking tribe. We speak Central Algonquin, which is the dialect we speak is Meskwaki, Sac, and Fox, Kickapoo. That's the dialect. But we kind of understand other Algonquin languages like Chippewa, Potawatomi, Shawnee, and a lesser degree to the Eastern Algonquins. And our birthplace is along the St. Lawrence River Valley. And us Indians have to keep reminding people that we're a very ancient people on this continent. We're contemporaries to mastodons, saber-tooth tigers. We lived there. We lived then when those animals were alive. And we remember very dimly, we remember that time.
Hmm.
And at one time, every Meskwaki boy wanted to be a big game hunter to kill that mastodon. But our creator told us they would be gone someday, and they were, you know. That's at the time he introduced the bow to us, and he told us that the things we use to hunt would be useless because the animals we killed with that atlo would be useless. So he introduced a bow to us. He said, use this someday. So for thousands of years, a bow and arrow was a children's toy. And so, and then we migrated down to Connecticut. Then we went to Niagara Falls in New York. Then we went to Ohio. Then we migrated into Michigan, Saginaw Bay, Detroit area. And that's when we enter European history in 1640. We get mentioned in the Jesuit relations. That's our first historic record of us, even though we've existed for thousands of years. So some people think that's when we came to being. So, but it isn't. And at that time, about 1650, we moved to Wisconsin. And in 1666, we finally met the French. And that didn't quite turn out well, because you know, when you meet people, sometimes you don't like them for no apparent reason.
Yeah.
That's the French for us. We didn't like them a lot, a bit. When we first met them, they didn't impress us. And by 1730, it was open warfare. Because we held the Wisconsin-Fox River route for trade, and they wanted that trade, pre-trade. So the Fox Wars, what history calls our war with the French, but we call it the Debeshkunag, which means at the time of the surrounded, you know. That's what we call our war with the French. And there's been an estimate that maybe there were about 40,000 Meskwakis alive by 1735. When we crossed the Mississippi into Iowa, we were maybe about 1,000.
Wow.
Maybe a little bit more. So you can imagine we still remember the French, but the French don't really remember us because they went on to Vietnam. They went on to Algeria. You know, so we're the Meskwakis are their first Vietnam because they didn't win. They lost the continent. Or else we would all be speaking in French. And we don't necessarily hate the French people. Our beef was with the French nobility. That's who ran the war.
Mm-hmm.
So we cursed the French, and we said, "May they eat each other." And after the Fox Wars, it was a little bit later, during the French Revolution, they killed their own nobility. And in the end, they did eat each other. So, there's Meskwaki still walking around the earth, and there's no French nobility.
Yeah.
So we won the war, we think. you know, we came into Iowa as refugees, I guess, fleeing the French and all their Indian buddies, which was practically the whole Great Lakes area tribes. We came into Iowa in 1735, and Iowa is our home today. And we love Iowa, the environment, the weather, you know. But in Iowa, archaeologically, we're very young. We're a very young culture in Iowa. There's older Indian tribes that lived in Iowa. But as you go east, we get older. In Wisconsin, we're a little bit older. We get to Michigan, we're a little bit older. When you get to Ohio, we're one of the oldest cultures in Ohio. And when you get into New York and beyond, they don't even recognize us. We're that old. But in Iowa, we're pretty young. But in a way, if you look at Iowa going east to Great Lakes, south to maybe Kentucky, if you look at that area, it's a bioregion. And we've always lived in our bioregion. In Iowa, we're towards the western end of our bioregion, but we're still within our bioregion. We still see the same trees, plants, insects, animals. If we cross the Missouri River, then we're out of our bioregion. And that's why we didn't like Kansas when we were removed to Kansas in 1845. Because it was just a little everything. Weather, insects, reptiles, different snakes, you know, more deadlier snakes. And we had to fight off other people for the dwindling buffalo herds that were being decimated by buffalo hunters. Fortunately, we came back to Iowa. And Iowa has been very good, you know, the state, its people. And we lived our traditional way of life clear up to World War II, which is a summer village and a winter camp. By World War II, that kind of life was ending because, first of all, the original settlers that we knew started dying off, and the farms were going to sons, which didn't know us that much. And by the time in the 1940s, it was going to grandsons that didn't know us at all. And census more closed off areas. We couldn't go to our traditional winter camp areas. So that life ended. All the tribes, we lived like our traditional way of life, which we were fortunate. It gave us time to adjust to this modern world. And it's about that made sense.
Well, yeah. Well, Jonathan, since you guys were there so long ago, and you know the memories and things about with mammoths and stuff like that, Did your tribe maintain the memory of kind of a changing of world ages and cycles? Like some of Mayan, Hopi, and stuff have different memories and stories of that. Do you guys have a
Well, what like our that, creator that one time, our creator mm-hmm. used to live with us.
Mm-hmm.
And one day he left the village. This is when we were still living on by the Atlantic Ocean. And he left for about a week, and the tribe started getting scared, panicky. You know, your creator just walked out.
Yeah.
Where is that, you know?
Not
what
a good
do,
sign,
what,
huh?
You know, and he came back a week later,
uh-huh.
and he had a bow and arrow in his hand.
Yeah, we're good. We're
and
on
he,
the quest or something?
He was showing the people, you know. I've just invented this, you know. So he's shooting
oh,
these
okay.
little arrows into the air, and people are looking. And then he tells us, you are big people because you eat big food. And he says, that's how come you're big. Because traditionally, Meskwakis were about 6 feet, very, very strong.
Mm-hmm.
Like most native people at that time. We were big people. Indians are the only people that have ever stopped Vikings. When they came to this continent, we chased them off. We're the only people that have done that in history. Everybody was afraid of Vikings. That's how big Indians were, not just Meskwakis. So, said, you're big people because you eat food. He says, but someday that food is going to be gone, going to disappear. And the next buffalo, the next animals you eat will be mega animals, like prehistoric buffalo, prehistoric elk. That's those big animals. He said, even those will be gone someday, and then you'll be eating deer and elk and moose and the next level of animal.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, even then those will be gone. Then you'll be eating raccoons, beaver. And that's when the people quit believing him, because to a people that eat big animals, being told they're going to be eating raccoons,
yeah.
it's like eating rodents.
Yeah.
You know? So he said, and that will change. Maybe not in your lifetime and not in your great-great-great-grandchildren's lifetime, but someday it will change. And he told us, but I'll always protect you. I'll always provide for you when that happens. So, eventually, those animals did disappear. And we were kind of in a struggle in during that change. So he came back, but by that time he didn't physically live with us. We talked to him through fasting by that time, because he physically left us in the East Coast. And because we say he went to go live where it's always winter. And when we say that to our grandchildren, our children, they think the North Pole.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we have to remind them that we used to live at the edge of the glacier. So when we say he went to go live where it's always winter, it means he climbed the glacier. And it used to, when you went to go see the creator, all you had to do was climb the glacier. But as the glacier retreated, so did he. So in time, by the time the big animals were gone, we only communicated with him through dreams and fasting. So we fasted during that hard time, and he gave us corn, beans, and squash. And then we became half hunting, half farming people. So, and that began a new life for us, you know, a new change. And over time we forgot that there was ever mastodons except very dimly, you know, very, very dim memory of just a couple stories, but actual remembering is gone, you know. So, and that's the life we still have today. Somewhat changed by modern life, you know, meaning the Americans. And but he said those it will reverse itself and we'll be going back, and eventually we'll go back to our original birthplace. Then then he'll come and live among us again, physically. So,
but well, we're not waiting. You're going, that may not be too far off.
But around, you know. We're not hoping, you know, because we're alive, you know, we're living. So
do a lot of your, Jonathan, do a lot of your, you know, a lot of your people, you know, still maintain their personal communication link through dreams and fasting and stuff to Creator?
There's quite a few, you know.
Mm-hmm.
In a tribe,
I just,
not everybody has to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there's people that still do that. You know. And it's just, there's people that do it for the tribe. So not everybody has to do it. Before, a long time ago, most people did it.
Yeah.
But not today, because it's a faster paced life. That sometimes it interrupts your that way of life. This modern.
Yeah.
So did Creator leave you any description of what it would be like, or things that would be happening before he would before you go back to your place of origin and he'd live with you again? Did he share anything with you?
Yeah, but it's like prophecy. He left us, okay, this is what's going to happen. We only recognize it after it happens.
Right.
He told us about another group of people coming would change our lives, and they did. He told us about space, going on in space, you know, about this gigantic eye in space that sees everything in all of creation, you know, things like that. And he taught, but we only recognize those after the fact that they happen. Then it's like a list until the end of our world, and that's the last thing on the list, so we keep crossing this. Oh, man did walk on the moon, you know, stuff like that. Man did fly, you know. So, but the end part is the end of our world, which isn't like what white people believe in. It's just a transfer, and it's like a restart button where everything in Meskwaki we call it when the Creator turns the world upside down.
Yep,
that's what he tips the world, and that makes new stuff. And life will begin. Our souls are don't die, you know, as Meskwakis. So our souls will just inhabit new bodies that that world creates. Then we'll start again, you know. And we will never remember this this world.
Well, it sounds a lot. That sounds a lot like what the Hopi shared and what would be happening. And yeah, Mark, you want to talk? You want to speak to that?
Well, yeah, it is not just a Hopi, but there's a number of. If you dig around in the ancient peoples. There's a number of people, I mean, all over the world. I mean, we're talking from, you know, up in Norway, Sweden, Polynesia, everywhere. Now, there's some islanders out in the Pacific that when certain things happen, they panic and say, you know, the world's getting ready to go upside down. And literally. And so, yeah, that pretty much fits with other people's description, and I think it also in the I know in some of the Hopi they believe that once we get through this next change, they think that they believe that the at least some of them believe that the axis is actually going to go straight up and down, so our 23.5 degree tilt is going to go away. Not all of them believe that, but there are a certain segment of them that do. And they also, you know, if you look at some of their stories, several of their clans, at least four of their clans, actually went to what they called the back door, which would be the pole land. They call also called it the land of ice. So, which kind of reminded me what he was saying about, you know, the glacier and where they came from and all that. But we are also science and people are looking at characteristics right now of the planet of us going into what we'd call a full magnetic field reversal of the planet. And that will bring about some of these things occurring. And that's we're seeing more and more indicators of that all the time. So I don't know if and Jonathan's if Creator gave them some lead-up signs like some of the other people. They were told certain things, you know, they'd see certain things, like the trees dying from the top down, changes in the animals, changes, very significant changes in their weather patterns, rains, and changes in the earth itself, and things like that. And we know that, for example, right now, here in the last few years, we know that our magnetic fields are declining significantly, and we're seeing now, hearing stuff this year about people saying that they got UV meters out seeing UVC type C radiation hitting the ground, which is not supposed to happen. So that's telling us that our fields are going. If they drop completely, then it brings about a bunch of other changes. And if the big problem would be is if we don't restart, in other words, if the core and the magnetic fields do not recover from the reversal and start again, then we end up like Mars.
Right.
And we don't. So probably, I think if everybody was aware of the situation right now, we'd probably be doing a lot of prayer and try to get on. Listen to Creator, and that's why I was asking Jonathan about everybody maintaining communication with Creator and just praying our eyeballs out and doing the right thing and getting back on track, because, you know, if we don't, it is possible, I'm not saying it would happen, but it is possible that we don't restart. And if that happened, it would be game over. There is not much, if any, life on Earth at all of any form, and that can happen. And so, and it's an out of balance situation with no magnetic fields and stuff. And that's one thing, Hopi talk about that. Many Native people talk about this balance of our, the way we act, the way we behave, the way we treat the planet, the way we treat each other, all that stuff. This isn't just religious mumbo jumbo. This is real. if we get so far out of whack that it can't be recovered, then it's game adios, bye-bye. Now, according to Hopi, we're going from the fifth to the fourth, or fourth to the fifth, I mean, and we get nine chances till the ninth world. So we got a few more chances. I'd probably say it'd be better to say that maybe we don't get any more chances. Maybe we better get it right now. You know? So that's why I was interested in Jonathan saying about, you know, what his tribe understood from the past and, you know, their maintain and their connection with the Creator and knowledge and wisdom that maybe they have learned that us and our listeners and everybody could take that knowledge and wisdom, whatever they had, in addition to the Hopi Maya and other people, and, you know, his tribe might have some other information or awareness or something that may help everybody so that we can kind of come together and work and get through this and quit having some of these problems and, you know, treat each other decently. And like Blue Otter and I say to most of the times on the show here, one of our main purposes is to help each person listening and all the people on Earth get their connection with the Creator so they have some spiritual guidance, so they got some brains and know what they're doing, the spiritual guidance system is working, so they start doing the right thing, and then we'll be okay. But if we don't, then we'll keep having problems like what you guys had with the French. You know, everybody will be doing it to each other. You know, same crap. So that's why I was asking you, Jonathan, about, you know, what those particular areas of what happened in the past and your knowledge of changes and also your people's ability to maintain their connection with the Creator.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it's things are getting really interesting in the world, and we do need to think about these kind of things. And, you know, even, you know, John Paul II, you know, what he described, what he told a few Catholics back in the mid-80s, and he told them basically was describing a, you know, an actual physical turning over of the world. So, and, you know, we were told it could be averted. So, we're, Jonathan, we're just out here crying in the wilderness, trying to get people's attention. And at least, you know, if the worst happens, we'll have some claim, you know, to say, hey, we tried. You know. So.
Well, you know what Blue Otter, what John Paul II said there about, what he basically said was the oceans would move on to over the land.
And
millions,
ice sheets.
And millions would perish.
Sheets
and,
of ice.
But he didn't mention the other parts of what Sister Lucia wrote down, and she didn't just say the oceans. She said the land and the sky. So your oceans aren't the only thing that move. It's the land. We could literally see sinkholes opening up that take out entire cities or sections of states or maybe an entire state. That can happen. And we could see our atmosphere literally go away or mostly go away. We could all be sitting there, kind of like when you're in a sweat lodge and, you know, it gets getting a little bit hot and you get down there next to the ground to get the cold air. You know? We could be doing that because there's no atmosphere.
Yeah.
And literally the sky falls, which means your atmosphere, your oxygen, and your things gets sucked off the planet, which is what happened to Mars. So we could be in for some pretty severe times.
Yeah, it's just like it was, just like described in that movie, The Day After Tomorrow, with Randy, you know, with.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
If the way I see it unfolding, people would be thankful if that's all that happened, because
yeah.
The other things that happen, it would be like one thing after another, and any one of them would be a problem, and that one was only one, you know, the ice and the ice age, and when you have a magnetic field reversal, the next thing that happens as you're going through it is you go into a full-blown ice age. And they're already talking publicly that we will be in what they would, some of the scientists are saying, a mini ice age by
2032.
That's right.
A mini ice age would be enough to take out about 50%, at least 50% of our food production.
And we only have to lower the ambient temperature, the average temperature, a few degrees to do that.
Yeah, it's people don't realize it. You know, we're already to some extent there, and on top of that, we also have increasing things about more and more stories about large magma chambers all over the place, not just
right.
here in the United States. The one up there in St. Helens, they were saying two. Now they're saying three or four, and it's all interconnected up there on the Pacific Coast. Well, remember what a lot of Native American tribes, they talked about that particular area of the United States, and they didn't really differentiate. They said it was like the whole thing. Well, now there's scientists starting to say there's magma chambers interconnected all over the place up there. And I've heard about another one that's off of, I think it's, I can't remember for sure. I think it was off the, I haven't researched it a lot, but I think it was off the coast of Australia or somewhere in Australia. And they said that one is big enough it could take out the entire planet.
Well, yeah, ask yourself.
It's giant.
Yeah, well, ask yourself why the Pacific Ocean is heating up. You know, it's
right.
got to be volcanism. That's the only thing that's going to heat up an ocean is a lot of volcanism. Well,
exactly.
Well, on a happier note, Jonathan, tell us about your powwows.
Oh, yeah. Mac asked about that, too. He wanted to know about the big powwow.
Well, our powwow is derived from our green corn tents. That happened in late August, early September. Our green corn dance was when we harvested the crops. And as we're doing our crops, you know, it's a lot of work. Drying your corn, squash, and beans. So that's when people would have dances in the evening. You know, you'd take a break, go dance, then go back to doing your corn. And that we did that since the days we received our corn, prehistorically. So we end up in Iowa, which ends up being good corn country.
Yeah.
We get removed to Kansas, we come back, and then we're on the settlement zone. And we're still doing the green corn dance. In 1902, we had a smallpox epidemic, so the government came in, quarantined us for about a winter. In the process, burned down our traditional houses, shot up our horses, shot up our dogs, and made us spread on our land so we didn't live in one village. But we still needed, so people started planting their corn and harvesting at their own time, you know, each family group.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't the same time. So people would go back to the village, old village site, and have the green corn dance without the harvest. By 1905, the original Lincoln Highway went through the village. Highway 30. And they started noticing, and this is in the early car stage. You know, people are starting to travel in cars, and they start noticing these cars parked in the field, and people watching them. So somebody had the idea, hey, let's charge these people to watch us. a nickel, you know. So we started charging people, which meant you'd have to make a gate, you know. So we made an enclosure with a gate that people had to pay to get in and watch us. And we didn't actually pay attention to our patrons, you know, the people watching us. They just watched us. There was no explanation of anything, you know. We didn't explain what we were doing. And then by 1913, we needed a name change. Oh, in the meantime, we tried to call it the Field Days. And we said, Meskwaki Field Days. And people came in. They expected a field meet, horse races, foot races, wrestling, and everything, you know, physical. And we said, no, that's not what we're doing. And then we tried fair, Meskwaki fair. And then when people came in, they expected a fair, you know, props, livestock, and everything. And I said, no, that's not where we need a simple word. And somebody said, hey, you remember when we used to pass those towns in our horses and little white kids would run on the side of our horses and go powwow, powwow. They said, white people already know that name. I know there's lots of different versions of the original where powwow came from. A lot of tribes claim we're the inventors of powwow. And I know that. So what I'm about to say is just our version of how we started using powwow to describe our traditional ceremony. And that's because powwow is an old Algonquin word, but it's spelled P-A-W-W-A-W, Bawa, which is how we pronounce powwow traditionally, Bawa. We say, Ki Bawa Hiben. We don't say, we're going to powwow. Because we're still saying it in the old Algonquin way, Bawa. So anyway, this old word moves up, and moves. When the white people get the word, they meant, oh, there's Indians. If they heard drumming, they would say, oh, the Indians are powwowing. Or they would go meet the Indians. I'm going to go powwow with the Indians. So that word has been around for a century in different usage. So when we chose it to name our ceremony powwow, we understood it to mean the Americans already understand it. When they see powwow, they know Indians gathering, singing, and dancing. So by 1914, that's the first time we used that word powwow to our ceremony, to our green corn dance. And that became the Meskwaki Indian powwow. And we do invite the public. We've always have from the very beginning. Some tribes don't quite understand that, but we do. And when we started asking people to come to see us, we had sort of a responsibility to explain what we were doing. So we had to start saying, oh, the next dance we're going to do is the bean dance. The next dance we're going to do is the buffalo head dance, and so on and so on. And there's a public and a private thing to our powwow. By Sunday evening, which we call performance, you know, but we're actually not performing. But for the sake of our audience, we say we're performing. there's hardly anybody else but us in the stands watching us, and we still do the thing. We still do the same thing. We still do our dances. And, but, you know, it's our powwow is not a religious event. It's a social. It's always been social for us. That's when sometimes you met your future mate, you know. And that was a time for our gathering. And because we, all summer long, we do our religious dances. So when powwow came along, sometimes you just want to dance for yourself, you know, just for the fun of it. So our powwow is dancing for ourselves just for the fun of it. And, but at the same time, it's semi-religious, because before the powwow, we have certain ceremonies we do. And after the audience leaves, we still have in the powwow because it's family's gathering. So it's a semi-religious event for us, because the dances that we're doing have religious meaning to them. But we just, for instance, like the bean dance. You know, we do the bean dance of a group of line of men and a line of women crossing at certain times. That's actually a fully, we're pollinating our crops. You know, female to male. But we don't say that in a way. We say the graceful movements of the bean dance, you know. And for the swan dance, which was traditionally actually a war dance. But we say this represents the graceful movements of the swan, you know. We don't go into the detail of what it was before. And we do that to all the dances. We simplify them, but we know the meaning, because we're not trying to convert people. We're not trying to convert people to our beliefs. So we give the explanation to our audience where they will understand and appreciate it and go home and say, I had such a great time at the Meskwaki powwow. But we still, even if nobody came to the powwow, we would still do it. And we have. So because it's important to us, it's our gathering time. It's still our traditional gathering time. And some tribes don't quite understand certain things we do, you know, because the idea of powwow culture has advanced beyond its original meaning. Now there's rules to powwow. You know, there's certain rules you have to do, which our traditional powwow we don't do sometimes. So sometimes when other Indians come to our powwow, they don't quite understand why we do certain things, why it's so simple. And they're not, it's not a religious event. And we keep telling them, we're not performing a ceremony in front of these people. It's so sacred. Don't do it in public, is what we believe. And we do a lot of sacred things that the public aren't invited to. Never knows, you know, what we do. But our powwow, it's like, come and watch us, but pay at the gate and leave. You know, we wish them a safe journey home, you know, but that's our powwow.
Well, that's good, excellent business practice.
It became a business, you know, even the chain, even the name change. Everything we do is geared to business, but still underneath there's that traditional thing we do among ourselves. You know, when we live in wikiups during the powwow, making them, living in them for 4 days and tearing them down, you know, things like that. So there's a lot of traditional things we do among ourselves. But when 1 o'clock comes along, if you're a dancer, you get ready. And when they say 1 o'clock, they say 1 o'clock.
It kind of reminds me about the state of Oregon's tourist policy. They say, yeah, come on in and enjoy the state, spend lots of money, and go home. You know, 'cause they don't want a lot of people. They don't want a lot of people moving to Oregon. A lot of people are. I think they said half of California is moving to Oregon. So, but that's outstanding. Well, we might have if there's somebody listening. Now we generally might have some live listeners. There'll be a lot of people that are listening to this. It'll be archived to be there, you know, as long as we're able to keep it up there. Anyway, but if you'd like to, if there's anybody out there that'd like to talk with Jonathan, the number to call is 347-996-3318. Or you can Skype in. There's a little Skype symbol next to the telephone number there on the browser page that you're using to listen to the program. Well, we're kind of winding things down, and want to thank you for appearing on here. It's been a learning experience for me because I personally have not read a lot about your people. I've heard some good things on you, but I actually didn't sit down and do some reading until over the weekend, and I'm glad I did. It's awfully nice to
meet. Do you read, and what did you think of us then?
Oh, I thought, man, what's the word? Courageous. There's only one word for it, and you know, to resist assimilation, and I wasn't raised traditional. You know, until I met Rolling Thunder back in 1985, I wasn't even, you know, I was told about my Cherokee genealogy when I was 16. I'm now 50. And it wasn't until I met Rolling Thunder, he really just rocked my world. And, you know, being raised in a staunch Republican family. And I still, you know, have some of those, you know, I agree with them on some things, and I agree with Democrats on some things, and disagree on both. I guess you call me a libertarian, but politically, and I won't go into a lot of detail, and to avoid any legal problems that might come up. But but anyway, no, just kidding. But I was trying to remember Wes Studi. I can't remember who he was portraying. I want to say he did a portrayal of Wovoka. I've seen it once or twice, and I think he mentioned the Sac and Fox. I'm trying to remember what.
I think that was Last of the Mohegans.
That's right. Okay. That's right. Yep. Magua. That's what it was. Okay. I couldn't remember what it was because he's portrayed so many.
They were saying they were going to take our land, and we said, come and try it.
Yeah. Well, you had 40,000 people at what time? In the 1600s?
Yeah. There's been an underestimation of the human population before Columbus.
Right. Well, gee, the Cherokee only had 50,000.
And there's been an underestimation. There were more people here than what people realize.
Sure.
But it's been to the advantage of the country to underestimate it, because it makes sense to take land away from these roving nomads than to take away land from a settled culture.
Right.
Because before the actual people came ashore, when the early French and English came, they were mostly fishermen, but they couldn't land their ships because there were so many Indians on shore that they couldn't physically land. And when they did land, they kind of robbed and raped and went away. But when they did come to land, they left disease, and they say that it killed 98% of the human population, and that our cities were made out of earth. So in the next 100 years, they became mounds. You know, they were no longer recognizable as what they were. So they became mounds. And we became smaller people. When the English start coming in with the intent of settling, they came ashore, and there's nobody there. So that's the idea has been, is like, we're not using the land. You know, we're just occupying the land because we're just nomads, you know. So that's been a problem because of that idea that they always had, that there was hardly anybody here. But there were millions of Indians here in pre-contact. And my wife and I read a book one time. It was about, and it didn't actually deal with Indians. It was about pristine woods. What's pristine woods in America? Can you find pristine woods? And the author, and I forgot the name of the book, but the author said, well, in America, hardly any place is pristine. And that's when he explained that disease that came, that pandemic that killed 98% of the human population. So he said when the pilgrims come ashore, what they see, the woods, is overgrowth. Because he said America prehistorically looked like what it does today, because most of the Indians were using the wood for fuel and shelter, just like everybody else. So when they all died, it got overgrown. It's just like if something happened in New York and all those people died and New York City was abandoned, eventually it would become ruins.
Sure.
Yep.
And in my line of work in NAGPRA, the idea of, you know, we always talk about these mounds, and sometimes we talk about them, and I always ask him, what are you trying to portray with these mounds? You know, because they're mostly in parks. People walk along paths and feel so, they say it's so peaceful. This must have been the Indian experience. You know, these Indians made these mounds, and it makes me spiritual. And I always tell them, what you're looking at are ruins. If they look like what they were made for, there would be a lot of people. It would be a noisy place. There'd be kids running around, dogs running around, old people walking around, people cooking, it would be a different experience. You know, the original people that occupied those mounds, it wasn't for a peaceful walk in the woods, because they're ruins. In certain parts of Detroit, I can go and see ruins of Detroit. Same thing, you know. So, that's what I always tell them. What are you trying to portray? If you're trying to portray ruins, you know, keep the ruins intact. But they're ruins. They're not. Indians didn't just go around making mounds, you know. They had their purpose, and they looked totally different when they were active, when it was an active culture. Just like when you go to Greece and you go to the Pantheon, you're walking around. I've never done that, but people go walk around the Pantheon, and it's a ruin, and there used to be deities that were prayed to at that place. But people don't believe in them anymore. Does that make sense?
It sure does.
Yep.
Kind of reminds me. Kind of reminds me of Floyd Red Crow Westerman's song, "Here Come the Anthros." Have you ever heard that song?
Uh-huh.
I'm gonna play that when we sign off. It's kind of funny.
Well, in NAGPRA, the federal law, we have come to. It's been more than 10 years, and during our powwow, we always invite the Iowa Archaeologist's Office to come and set up beside us, because my wife and I run the exhibit tent. And some people always question why there's state archaeologists. Well, we have a very good relationship with the Iowa State Archaeologists. They've helped us. Iowa has the best burial, reburial laws, state laws in the country. And that's where this repatriation stuff started, is in Iowa.
Really?
And so we have a very good relationship. Like, we have a good relationship with the archaeologist that does our archaeology in Wisconsin. And but, you know, that's our experience. I like the Kennewick man. They finally found out that, oh my God, he was an Indian, you know. After all, you know. And when they thought he was a white guy, they did the restructure of the skull. They made him look like Patrick Stewart.
Okay.
And when they said, no, he's Japanese. So they redid it, and they made him look like a Japanese guy. And I told, because we all, every tribe had their support letters for the tribe in Washington. And what the Sacken Fox said was, if we shave our heads, if every Indian shaved their heads, we would all look like the guy. So, and I was going to make a T-shirt, and it was going to say, scientists discovered that Kennewick man was from Mars. So I was going to reconstruction of the skull and make it look like Martian, you know, eyes poking out and stuff.
Yeah, right. That's funny.
So,
wow.
You know, not all archaeologists and anthropologists are enemies. It depends on if they've been a little bit better now. We have better relationships with anthropologists. They have their use. They can teach, you know. Because with the archaeologist in Wisconsin, there's a certain type of pottery called the Bell pottery from the Bell site, which is our old village. So they were trying to make that pottery. So that one year they came down here and they taught us how to make our old pottery. So now today we know how to make our old style pottery. And no, but then I've met some archaeologists that I'm not impressed with. It depends on where. And it's because one thing I found out about NAGPRA, working with NAGPRA, is the country. And it's subconscious. They think they still own us. They still think they own our history. They still think they own the right to express that history. And they own our objects. But us Indian tribes, us Indians, have to keep saying, we're the experts of my people. Everybody, you know, I'm the expert. And you have to keep saying that. I'm the expert.
Yeah, it's not like we go digging up their grandmothers, you know.
Yeah.
And that argument doesn't usually work because they do dig up their grandmothers. You know, if there's better use for that land, they will dig up their grandmothers.
Yeah.
Which is all right to them. You know, they have no problem with that. They have no problem. You know.
Well, that's true.
So,
well, we're going to run on a stream in about 2 minutes.
Gonna
let you go. I want to play.
What radio station is?
Well, it's just on the internet. I'll send you a link to the show so you can put up a link on your website. I've already put it up on a couple of the Mishwaukee Facebook. Well, I put it up on the casino website Facebook. Page and you'll be, the people will be able to listen to this anytime they want to, at their leisure. How's that sound?
Oh, okay. I'll just tell them. Good. My wife was wondering. She goes, "Who are these people?"
I don't know. We've been around since about 2004, and I think we've done about 250 broadcasts, and hope to do a lot more. But let me roll this before we start losing the stream. Appreciate you. Thanks so much,
okay.
Jonathan. And give our best to your wife and your people.
Okay.
Thank you. Here's Floyd Wedcrow Westerman's Here Come the Anthros.
Coming like death in taxes to our land, to study their feathered freaks with funded money in their hands. Like a Sunday at the zoo, the cameras look away, taking notes and tape recordings of all the animals at play. Here come the anthros and hide your past away. Come the anthros on another holiday. And the anthros bring their friends to see the circus, watch the show. And when their pens are untried, they pack up the things and away they go. But there's nothing left to study, there's nothing left to see. Still the their book and tell the world there's more, but there's nothing left to write, it's all been done before. And on a cent of funded money,
that the anthrope get to spend was ever given to their disappearing feathered friend. Here comes the anthrope, better hide your past away. Here comes the anthrope on another holiday. And the anthropes keep on digging our sacred ceremonial sites. As if there was nothing wrong, cause education gives them the right. But the more they keep on digging, the less they really see. Cause they got no respect for you or for me. Here come the anthropes, better hide your past away. Here come the anthropes on another holiday.
Join us to learn how to legally worship using indigenous earth-based healing and empowering ceremonies. Friends, this is your co-host, Will Bluewater. Join us now to learn how to legally worship using indigenous earth-based healing and empowering ceremonies. Aho.